From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. The climate change talks in Paris are scheduled to close this Friday, which means it's crunch time. There are still big sticking points about how aggressive and binding the commitments should be, about how much the developed world should help the less developed world. Every sentence matters now, and the negotiation is still tough. This hour on Point, we look at the home stretch with everything on the line in Paris. You can join us on air or online where this conversation is always on. How will you measure success or failure in Paris? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. People came with very high hopes here. Hopes are still very strong coming out of Paris. But the latest version of the document that will come out here has just been released in Paris, and it still has a lot of unresolved issues. Earlier in the conference on Monday, we heard the UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon saying, we have to get this done. Ban Ki-moon.
The global thermostat is rising. This year has been the warmest in recorded history. There is no time to lose. Science tells us the window could soon close on our ability to prevent severe and irreversible climate impact.
No time to lose, says the UN chief, and yet there's still a lot to be worked out. In Paris today, the U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry spoke, saying he would double climate adaptation grants to developing countries from the U.S., making more than $860 billion in grants available by 2020.
My friends, here in Paris now, we have the rarest of opportunities to actually change the world, to improve the lives of billions of people. And in the next few hours, we need to work as never before not to let this opportunity slip by. We need to do whatever it takes to have the tough conversations that we need to have, to make the compromises that we need to make, and to give the world the agreement that it deserves and demands.
I said billion, should be million, 860 million now, doubling that by 2020 from the United States. That in itself has been an issue here. There are plenty of issues still. And given the stakes here, given what's on the line, we want to work through those today to see where all of this stands. Copenhagen was deemed ultimately a failure. Everybody wants this one to, I shouldn't say that, most of the world wants this one to succeed. Will it? Joining me now from Paris is John Cushman, editor and reporter for Inside Climate News, author of Keystone and Beyond. John Cushman, Jack, it's good to have you back. Thanks for joining us.
Hi, Tom. Glad to be here.
And with us from Providence, Rhode Island, is Timmons Roberts, professor of environmental sociology at Brown University, also a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution. He took a delegation of students to the Paris Climate Talks, returned Sunday night, author of Power in a Warming World. You can link to his blog at our website, onpointradio.org. Timmons Roberts, thanks for joining us today.
Tom, great to be with you.
Jack, you're there. You're on top of it in Paris. And here we are today. This latest draft has come out. We've just got a couple of more days here now. I'm reading that it's been carved from 48 pages down to 29, but there are still 100 places in this draft where decisions remain to be made. Alternative language alternatives there, blank spaces there. What are the still open issues at this point, Jack?
Well, I think that there are probably 10 or 15 open issues. Maybe half a dozen are the most prominent. And the more prominent one of these issues is, the later it is going to be resolved. That's just in the nature of bargaining. So this text is a little simpler than it was a few days ago, but it still is in the running as the most complicated document written in Paris since Finnegan's Wake, I would say.
Timmons Roberts, you wrote recently, just a couple of days ago, asking whether there was a risk of another Copenhagen here, of a flameout, ultimately. Do you see that?
Okay, so in Copenhagen, Tom, the problem was that the texts coming up through the UN process were a mess in the Wednesday. That's exactly now, in the second week of the negotiations. So 6 years ago, in 2009, in Copenhagen, there were two documents coming up. They were supposed to be merged into the Copenhagen Accord. And then what happened was that there was just too many brackets. There were too much unagreed text. So
brackets,
what happened
this
was,
is language that's still kind of in parentheses and unresolved, disputed.
Right. And right now they're trying to remove brackets. And apparently in this latest draft that was just released about 2 hours ago, there is three quarters of the brackets are gone. So that's good news. But there's still, as you said, over 100 big issues to work out literally in the next day because they have a deadline tomorrow. But what happened in Copenhagen was President Obama found the leaders of BASIC, the four large emerging economies, Brazil, South Africa, India, and China. And in a back room, they hammered out this Copenhagen Accord, which totally changed the way that we do governance of climate change, how we're going to deal with this issue.
And yet, they had to go for very broad strokes because they could not get to the rich full agreement that so many had hoped for, and it was ultimately deemed a failure. Jack, at this point, where is progress most obvious? What looks most promising, and what looks most problematic?
Well, let's see. What these small groups that were meeting over the past day or so in order to present this draft were trying to do was identify landing zones, as they called them, where the people were still circling the airport, but at least they thought they might be able to see the landing zone. And I think, for example, in this question of what the long-term goal of the treaty ought to be, they're closing in on a landing zone where they're going to reaffirm the target of coming in at less than 2 degrees Celsius of warming by the end of the century compared to the beginning of the industrial age, but they're going to tighten it by saying as far below 2 degrees as possible and maybe make some reference to the scientific evidence that 1.5 degrees of warming would be a lot safer for a lot of people, depending on where they live. So that's a very significant piece of progress that's played out in the past few days, and I would think that would be one that they ought to have little trouble resolving. There's been an issue at the talks about how much attention to pay to forests and forestry and land use, which are major contributors to the problem and also offer major opportunities to solve the problem, because forests soak up carbon, and if you don't chop the forest down, they don't release carbon. So I think that at this point, things are looking good, that forests will get a proper place in this treaty. There's been some progress, I believe, on what they call ratcheting up, the speed with which countries are going to be asked to revisit their commitments. And this is a very difficult promise for many countries to accept. But it looks like some countries will start ratcheting up a little sooner. Some will start ratcheting up a little later. But by 2030, everybody will be on a common pace of revising their promises every 5 years. And that's very important because the promises that have been made so far are inadequate to solve the problem. So everybody understands that Paris is supposed to set a binding process in motion to improve performance. And then I'll mention one that seems to me to still be a problem, the so-called loss and damage issue. This is the notion by countries that are most likely to be hit hardest and to be unable to pay for the risks of global warming that are already locked into the system. And here I think that the U.S. and some other countries have made this a red line and said we're not going to accept liability and compensation provisions in this treaty. But the U.S. and those other countries do recognize that they have responsibilities, and they're going to have to come up with a way to finesse that one. And it's going to be finesse or fail, I think, on loss and damage. So, again, there are maybe a dozen or 15 different issues like this that are unresolved. But one reason they're unresolved is that different coalitions and different nations are holding them in reserve as final elements of the horse trade. And so maybe tomorrow morning, after these delegates have been up all night going over this treaty, we'll see a little more progress.
We're going to go through this point by point because each of these has really big implications and consequences. Timmons, you wrote that this is going to be, the finale is going to be a nail biter. Does it still look that way to you?
It does look like a nail biter. There has been progress on a number of things, as Jack just laid out. I think that was a great account, and there are some big ones still. But I think the tone is quite different this time, that there is a, sort of a positive vibe in Paris, that people trust the presidency of the French government as they're running this. We have the Conference of the Parties 21 president, Laurent Fabius, is there in the chair, sort of sending out the troops and bringing people in from different parts of the world to hash out these 10 different issues in these little subcommittees, and they seem to be making some progress. And I do agree, as Jack said, that people are holding their cards for that last night of horse trades, because really you don't want to give everything away too early, or else you're going to lose on your own issues.
John Kerry has just doubled the amount of money the American government would put in to helping people adapt to climate change, at least proposing that. I don't know what he has to bring back and ask. Presumably he has to ask Congress for that money. But from $430 million to $860, is that a big deal, Jack Cushman, in Paris?
Well, it's a significant piece of the puzzle, but hundreds of millions and billions don't begin to address what's needed over the long term here. Before too long, if this problem is going to be solved, there are going to have to be shifts in the capital markets on the order of $1 trillion a year. And it's simply not going to be governments who provide that scale of finance. So I think that one of the things that we've seen here at the COP is an emphasis on the role of the private sector, of large banks, to some extent progressive corporations, and also some way of finding new mechanisms to enhance capital flows and to allow the developing world to be able to use that money effectively.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking about crunch time at the Paris Climate Talks. Negotiators down to the tough nitty-gritty now. Success or failure on the line, and what they each would mean. Timmons Roberts is with us from Brown University. He's just been in Paris with a big delegation of students watching everything going on there back Sunday night. Jack Cushman is still there in Paris, editor, reporter for Inside Climate News, keeping track of everything going on in those talks right now. Just today, a trimmed-down document has come out with 700-plus points of dispute negotiation down to about 100, but that's still 100, and some of them are big deals. You can join the conversation this hour. After all the photo ops, do you see the Paris talks lining up for success? Have you heard the challenge? Almost, still 100 points of contention, the line-by-line battles there, and what's make or break to you in this agreement? Who promises what? What kind of monitoring? Who pays for what? What's the goal? The timing. John Kerry in Paris on Monday said, get this agreement and we are on a new path for change.
If 184 plus nations sign on to a durable agreement with review and accountability and transparency here in Paris, you watch the world begin to change.
Cristiana Figueres, who's pushing this for the UN, talked there on Monday saying, look, we've come this far. Now it's up to you, delegates. Get it done.
It is now up to you to deliver an agreement that safeguards the most vulnerable and unleashes the full force of human ingenuity toward prosperity for all as the centerpiece for a sustainable future.
But there are still big sticking points here, points of disagreement. Who's going to pay for what in terms of adaptation and even what they call liability and compensation, loss and damage as climate change continues to kick in? Yesterday, here was the Minister of Environment and Forests from India. This is Prakash Javadekar talking at a press conference about the developed countries, read USA and others, need to step up financially.
It is imperative that developed countries who have the historical responsibility must take the visible lead in cutting emissions and providing financial and technological support to the developing world. The world was expected to mobilize $100 billion up to 2020, but it has not made much headway.
And then, say my guest today, it's trillions we're talking about here. You can join us. Timmons Roberts, Jack Cushman, let's walk through some of these big issues. Jack, you said that a consensus seems to be emerging that the goal will be to keep global warming under 2 degrees centigrade by the end of this century. Timmons, there were many, Africa in particular, where some of the impact is expected to be the most severe and soon, who wanted that to go to 1.5. Do you see them ready to just take 2 and deal with the consequences?
Absolutely not. Actually, Tom, that's been a huge change in the last week, that a new coalition called the Climate Vulnerable Forum has really emerged as a powerful force in this, and they've pulled together the Association of the Small Island States, a lot of the African countries, other low-lying countries that see the impacts first. And, of course, the impacts are for everybody, but they're quite different. So in some of the mountainous places, they rely on glacial melt for their drinking water and their agriculture. Those places are extremely vulnerable because those glaciers are disappearing fast. Other places are dealing with typhoons and droughts and wildfires and so on. So this most vulnerable forum is quite interesting because they've really managed to shift the discourse from a 2-degree target, which was kind of a consensus of a guardrail that the world's countries should stay within to avoid the worst impacts of climate change, to avoid dangerous climate change. But other science has said, well, wait a minute, we're right now at right around 1 degree, and this is 1 degree centigrade, right?
So we're already up over pre-industrial levels, yes?
Correct, right. So now they're saying really 1.5 would be a lot safer. In fact, that 2 degrees is entirely unsafe for Africa, for the Arctic, for these other places that we're already seeing these impacts. So just in terms of Fahrenheit, the difference is between 2.7 degrees Fahrenheit and 3.6. So of increase over the pre-industrial era.
Mm-hmm.
And the problem is that now it looks like we're headed to about 5 degrees Fahrenheit. So that's almost double what people think is safe. That's including all the pledges that have been made this year. And those pledges have been extremely important. They've really put a push behind these negotiations. And it's gotten countries thinking all across their government agencies and in their society more broadly as they came up with these pledges and plans to think about what they're going to do in different parts of the economy to reduce their emissions and what they could do.
Hold that thought. Jack Cushman, right now, even with all the pledges on the table, we're well over the 2 degrees. And as you say, this is going to require ratcheting up commitments and action over time. And maybe they're moving toward a schedule for how all that would work. But what about this lower target in the first place? You say consensus seems to be coming together around 2 degrees, but as Timmons pointed
out, you misheard what I said.
Yes, please.
Was that they're going to maintain the 2-degree figure, but the language is likely to refer to coming in as far as possible below 2 degrees.
Yeah, I heard exactly what you said, and to me, if I'm sitting in Africa, that's a big difference. That's not a 1.5 degree commitment.
And I think that they will make a reference to the reasons to strive for 1.5 degrees. There are two ways of looking at this. One is that to get to 1.5 degrees requires an intense acceleration of effort here. And it would, in fact, require a greater degree of removing carbon dioxide from the atmosphere as opposed to simply focusing on not adding more. But the other way of looking at it is, as I explained on a piece in Inside Climate News this morning, the differences in the slopes between 2 degrees and 1.5 degrees over the next 15, 20, 25 years are not that profound. And so the technologies that are required, the changes that would be required are very similar. The speed with which you adopt them are so fast that some people doubt that they can be made. And countries are cautious about signing on to something when they doubt that they can achieve it. And so therefore, they're going to fudge this difference to some extent by saying, let's go as deeply below 2 degrees as possible with an eye on 1.5 degrees. It's a kind of a subtle change. It doesn't write its way into headlines very accurately, but it is a very significant change. And, of course, if the countries of the world can be held to that, then it would be breathtaking speed in the adoption of renewable energy and the move away from fossil fuels.
So maybe there's the fudge that makes agreement possible on this front. It puts an element of uncertainty out there, but as you say, it's just, in practical terms, it's just out there, that uncertainty. What about, Timmons, you've looked at whether countries, developing countries like China, India, Brazil, are going to be expected to make absolute reductions in their CO2 emissions, not just to bring down the rate of growth, but to make real reductions. Where does that stand?
Right. So in the document, there is really not anything saying that they should have to make absolute reductions. It's all based on, because of the historical responsibility of the wealthy countries for the problem. I mean, most of the carbon dioxide and other greenhouse gases in the atmosphere that are up there are ones that we put up there from the wealthy countries. Now, and it was agreed back in 92 in the original Framework Convention on Climate Change that countries would act according to their common but differentiated responsibilities and respective capabilities, which is a long phrase meaning that everybody caused the problem, but some people caused a lot more of it, and that the countries that have more money should act first and who caused the problem. So there, that's kind of off the table that developing countries would have to have absolute emissions reductions at this time. They would be expected probably to move to those in the future. There's one proposal from Brazil that has countries moving towards the more sort of economy-wide and absolute reductions that you're talking about.
Can we talk about the money here? Developed nations are expected to pay a lot to help poorer countries adapt and bring in alternative energy sources, become more efficient in their energy use. Jack, you're saying that you talk about millions, and that's chump change here. It's going to be billions. It's going to be trillions ultimately. Part of the debate has been whether developing country governments like the United States will commit to putting that money in themselves or whether it will come from private finance. Who in the private sector is going to shell out the money to pay for this? Why would they do that in the trillions?
Well, one reason is that a lot of the harm that occurs as a consequence of global warming is insured. And therefore, there's a big chunk of the private sector involved in the insurance business. And they absolutely would like to see companies whom they insure be more resilient to the kind of damages that everybody, not just developing countries, but every country faces. John Kerry just mentioned today that the United States last year spent, I believe he said the number was $160 billion within the United States on damages from severe weather events. And so the U.S. is, within its own borders, investing very heavily for this resilience or adaptation funding. I think that in a global economy, all the countries in the world, all the companies in the world who operate across borders have an interest in seeing those places where they operate be protected against climate damages. If you remember when there was 2 years ago or so intense flooding in Thailand, the deliveries of Apple computers in the United States were set back because most of the companies that were making hard drives and other components for these computers were located in Thailand. And so these complex supply chains are a powerful incentive for big multinational corporations to protect across borders against the damages from climate change.
But I still don't quite get, Jack, if I may, how exactly would that work? Is Apple going to cut a check for a billion or billions of dollars? Apple and many other private companies just going to shell it out to, how would that work?
Well, I'll tell you something. Apple has a lot of cash, and it was not an impossible thought to think that in order to protect its global supply chain, Apple would provide money to countries like Thailand, for example, that are vulnerable to climate disruptions, because it's not in Apple's business to 1 year have Christmas spoiled by flooding in Thailand. And so I don't find it implausible at all that Apple, which has already moved to green up its supply chain, mm-hmm. and which is already taking measures such as buying renewable energy in large bulk, should contribute to an insurance scheme, for example, that would help these third world countries adapt. I don't find that implausible at all.
Timmons Roberts, much of the world has said, wait a minute, the private industry may have an interest here, but how do we count on them to actually put the money down? We trust governments to say they'll do it if they, at least we trust them more. And that's been a point of contention in Paris, as I understand it. Are people coming around to trusting that there will be private finance here available for this? Because money is a big deal for adapting.
Oh, absolutely. And Jack makes some good points there. But I do think it's not going to be a system that will really address the needs of the most vulnerable to wait for private industry to come to their aid, because they will go to the places where they have manufacturing facilities and so on. So a lot of Africa will be left out, for example, in some of these small island states that are the most vulnerable. So while the private funding is absolutely key and that we need to really create the market signals, the incentives for investors to put into renewable energy and to invest in protecting their infrastructure against, rising seas and, greater flooding and so on, we really do need some public funding. And that is a big bone of contention, because it was promised back in Copenhagen as part of the way that the five countries managed to get this deal through the rest of the UN system, was to promise to poor countries this $100 billion a year by 2020 that was mentioned by Prakash Javender from India. And the problem is that pledge was very vague, and it included private and public funding, and it included grants and loans. And then so in their reporting of what they're actually delivering, the countries of the wealthy parts of the world are including all kinds of things that I think were not really in the spirit of the promise, and certainly were not in the spirit that the poorer countries of the world agreed to that Copenhagen Accord. And so a lot of the work of my lab group, the Climate and Development Lab at Brown University, working with other groups such as Adaptation Watch, we just put out a report showing that, in fact, there's a lot of creative accounting, as India and others have pointed out. Oxfam, in a very similar kind of research, and some other think tanks have done work showing that there really needs to be, first of all, a real definition of what climate change finance is, what things should count. I mean, if we're, for example, the U.S. government giving export credits or sort of insurance to American corporations as they invest abroad, does that count as climate finance? Should that, if it is somewhat climate related, I don't think that's really what developing countries expected.
Could this be a deal breaker, Timmons, or not? Or people are going to, developing countries going to say, well, it's not what we wanted, but we've got to stay on board here. Or could that be the deal breaker?
It could be a deal breaker. I think I do believe that there is enough goodwill in the world right now and enough determination that the countries of the world want to come in with some kind of an agreement. The question is whether we're going to get one that includes real ambition. And the language is really interesting in this now two-hour-old draft that talks about how the developing countries will do more if they receive more finance. And that's actually what India has said. Rajendra Modi, the prime minister, said, if you want us to not build those coal-fired power plants using all this soft coal that we're sitting on top of, well, great. Make your investments here. We can reduce a lot of emissions if you, help us, if you invest in India, for example. So I think it's maybe not the deal breaker, but it'll be the difference between an ambitious deal and sort of a lowest common denominator.
Jack, we've got half a minute before the break here. Do you see in this latest draft progress toward a deal on the money side, this side of adaptation?
What I don't see is a binding figure with a target figure that says that any developed country is going to be legally bound as a matter of international law to give X hundred million or billion dollars by a date certain. What I do see is language that says that climate finance will be new, it will be additive, it will be effective, it will be growing, and that the mechanisms for providing it will be transparent and verifiable. We want a durable treaty, but a durable treaty can't be a blank check, because there's nothing less durable than a blank check.
On Point is sponsored by Casper, an online retailer of premium mattresses made in America. They are engineered for comfort and long-lasting support with just the right sink, just the right bounce. Two technologies, latex foam and memory foam, come together for better nights and brighter days. It's outrageous comfort at a polite price. Here's the great part. You can try one risk-free for 100 days with free delivery and returns. Get $50 toward any mattress by visiting casper.com/onpoint. That's casper.com/onpoint. And remember to use promo code ONPOINT at checkout to receive this special offer. Terms and conditions apply.
I'm Tom Asbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about crunch time at the Paris Climate Talks. Negotiators down to the really tough nitty-gritty now, but not small details. Still big, big issues on the table. We're looking at what each of those would mean for the climate and for coming to a successful conclusion after all the anticipation of Paris. Jack Cushman is with us from Inside Climate News, editor and reporter there. He's in Paris. Timmons Roberts is just back from Paris, has been at the talks, and he's at Brown University now, back in the States, and joins us from Providence, Rhode Island. You can join us as well. What is make or break to you in this agreement? And when you see the rivers running through Greenland's ice and the islands disappearing, can you imagine this not getting done? What's your question on the Paris deal 2 days before it's supposed to wrap up? Last week, here was President of Benin, President Boni Yayi, in Paris, talking about Africa's stakes in the climate talks.
Et pour nous, l'Afrique est venue pour faire en sorte que la COP 21.
Saying, for us, Africa has come to be sure this succeeds. We have no choice. There's no plan B solution. We need it. We need an agreement here and now. That, in brief, is what our continent wants. Of course, back in the States, especially in the GOP, not even agreement that this is a problem. Here was Chris Christie on MSNBC last week.
The climate's always changing, and we cannot say that our activity doesn't contribute to changing the climate. What I'm saying is, it's not a crisis. The climate's been changing forever, and it will always change. And man will always contribute to it.
It's not a crisis, says Chris Christie, and he's not the only Republican candidate for president who's in that mode. Nona in Toivola, Michigan. Nona, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. You are a delight. But I live in the Keweenaw Peninsula in the, you know, the Upper Peninsula of Michigan.
Yeah.
And a lot of these businesses here, they make their money with snowmobiles and ski slopes, and there is zero snow. There is no snow in December. I can't believe naysayers of climate change. I can't believe the Republicans going against what the president wants to do with financing helpful things for around the world. But the kicker is, last week, my son pulled a wood tick off of our dog, and I thought that was like an anomaly. And then the neighbor guy said that the same thing happened with him and his dog.
In December.
There should be no wood ticks in Toivola in December.
There's a little firsthand testimony out of the Upper Peninsula in Michigan. And Nona, I appreciate your call. Let me hold that thought about the U.S. Congress here and or a next president and their role vis-a-vis these negotiations in Paris. First, Dave in Stowe, Massachusetts. Dave, you're on the air.
Hey, Tom. Thanks for taking the call. And
yes.
Thanks so much for covering this issue.
Yeah.
I have a concern. I was hearing you, we were talking about the 1.5 versus 2 degrees Celsius temperature rise as being a really important distinction in terms of the effects on the most vulnerable countries and all.
Those very ambitious goals would take a lot of work to hold the temperature rise to that, but that's what's on the table. So where are you going with that, Dave?
Well, here's the deal. Given that there's a bit of uncertainty in the models, which of course is used by skeptics slash deniers to, you know, attack them, but given that is this uncertainty in the models, what if we're off by a little bit? And is there a way for the negotiation to address this so we can say, geez, you know, we're actually, what we thought was going to give us 1.5 is really only going to give us 2.5. I mean, that's a big concern of mine. I mean, obviously, you know, developments in renewable energy and things like that are going to be on the positive side, but improvements and that sort of thing. What can your guests say about that?
Let us pick it up. Timmons Roberts, what about the margins of uncertainty here? If climate change is faster and worse than modeled, is there any mechanism for responding? Or if it's not as bad as expected and modeled, what about in that case?
Right. So in the draft text here, there are sections that talk about using the latest science that it would be updated every 5 years, you know, and it's through the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, which has been doing this for years, which is thousands of scientists around the world, and then it's approved by the governments of the world went before their sort of executive summary comes out. But if the science changes, and I think Dave might be right, that the impacts are coming faster and that once we get to certain temperatures, for example, the tundra starts to melt and methane is released to the atmosphere, we really don't know. These models are best guesses by hundreds or thousands of scientists, but really we have not seen these kind of temperatures and carbon dioxide levels in the atmosphere for hundreds of thousands of years. So there has to be an opportunity for this to, for the system to be ratcheted up as time goes on. Every 5 years, there'll be a global stock take in the latest version. So then there will be, the need to increase their ambition. And I want to just talk about Nona's points about the lack of snow and wood ticks. I mean, I think this is one of the tailwinds that I talk about in a recent blog on the Brookings page, for example, that people are now perceiving climate change in a different way than we did even just 5 or 6 years ago. For example, here in Rhode Island, we did a little analysis that showed that summers are now about 3 weeks longer than they were when I was a kid. And there's 3 weeks more days over 80 of heat index, and that's in New England. People are just noticing that things are not right. I mean, certainly the warm weather is pleasant. It's been a beautiful fall up here. But people are starting to say, wait a minute, this is just not right. And then when it gets around to summer, it's going to be quite miserable.
And Jack,
I think that helps a lot.
Yeah, well, people notice, and that's true. Jack Cushman, what about this so-called stocktaking? That is monitoring, I guess, whether countries are living up to their commitments under this agreement. Where's the language stand on what's voluntary, what's not voluntary? Is there going to be something like the IAEA, the Nuclear Monitoring Organization, that can come in and has a right to go in and really look at the books and look at what's on the ground in terms of power plants and all the rest to see if countries are being honest, straightforward about what they're doing or not doing?
Yes, and like everything in this treaty, this question of transparency is a divisive one, because there are some countries that are very reluctant to have their books scrutinized as closely as they might be by the world community. I heard Todd Stern, the chief negotiator, the other day say that in the course of the negotiations, as they went back and forth about this, he said the transparency provisions in this agreement can't be two sentences long. They're more likely to be two pages long. And the reason is that, like everything else in the agreement, there's the differentiation, the divide between the rich and poor countries. And the poor countries are saying, wait, we're doing the best we can, but don't ask us to go back and reprove ourselves every few years. And the rich countries are saying, you're asking us to commit finance and loss and damage assistance and ratchet up our financial contributions, but banks don't willingly write loans, and neither do governments issue grants willingly without the right degree of security that the investment is going to play out well. And so I don't believe that this is a showstopper, but I would say that section on transparency is complicated. And the question of where in the agreement it goes, how binding it should be on the various parties, whether the bindingness should be different for different categories of states, these are the issues that they're going to be talking about all night long. As to the uncertainty question that your guest just asked, of course, there's always going to be uncertainty about projections of the climate. This whole treaty is driven by the world's need to address an issue before it becomes so apparent that the models were right, that it's too late to do anything about it, because the carbon dioxide that we add to the atmosphere today continues to have effects for centuries, if not for a millennia or longer. But one thing you can say is there's uncertainty on the downside and there's uncertainty on the upside of warming. But the uncertainty on the downside is constrained. We've already got 1 degree of warming. The uncertainty on the upside is much less constrained. So that
by upside, you don't mean a positive development. You mean a higher warming than expected.
Hotter, hotter, and hotter, and feedback loops that warm the planet are much more likely. If there's a risk that things are going to be worse than expected, and a risk that things are, or a chance that things are going to be better than expected, it would be unwise to bet that things are going to be better than expected.
Let me get one more perspective on all this for just a minute here. Adam Goldstein joins us now from Paris. He's a senior at Emory University, studying history and business there, and he's with a class in Paris as an observer of the talks. Adam, in Paris, thanks very much for being with us.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
I'm great, my friend. What's your gut? Is this going to happen, Adam? Is everybody there saying, yes, we're going to have a great agreement? Here you are, a young observer. Does it look like it's on track to you or not?
Yeah, well, you know, this is my first COP, but the energy is unbelievably vibrant. And what sort of stood out the most in the past week and a half here is that everyone has been saying, you know what, this is so much different than Copenhagen. This is so much different than 5 years ago. We're no longer debating whether or not this is happening. It's happening. We see it in front of us, and we need to do something about it. So, you know, that's hearing that from people who've been through this at Copenhagen and since Kyoto, yeah, it makes me optimistic.
You're just into your 20s. Can you feel what's on the line here for your lifetime, which should contain most of the rest of this century, Adam?
In every single event I've been to, no matter if I was the only young person there or one of many, people have said it's all about the millennials. The millennials are going to have to be the people who take this on their backs and figure it out. So yeah, it feels real, and being here in Paris, surrounded by so many people who are passionate at different levels, whether it be grassroots, business, politics, it feels real, and it feels like something that we need to act on now. And as someone in their early 20s, is something that my generation can hopefully work towards.
A lot of people went home disappointed from Copenhagen. We're hoping that doesn't happen for you in Paris. Adam Goldstein out of Emory University. Thank you very much for being with us, Adam.
Thanks, Tom.
Richard in Boca Raton, Florida. Richard, you're on the air.
Hey, Tom.
Hey.
My question stems from some pessimism and is basically based on this question. Can this treaty, even if it's a good treaty signed by all nations in the world, survive the opposition, the active opposition of the Republican Party and its partners in the coal and oil industry to sabotage by defunding anything that may be agreed upon by the United States?
We'll pick it up. And, of course, it is not technically a treaty, largely because of that expected opposition within the U.S. Congress and really within the GOP. Timmons, what about it? We're hearing, and there's plenty of foot already in the U.S. Congress to counter some of the president's moves here. We heard the Energy Secretary Moniz saying, we're going to step up and do what we've promised here. But can the U.S. really promise that when you've got congressional opposition at home?
Actually, I was asked by China Dialogue to write a blog about that. Is Obama's promise durable? Is it going to be durable in Paris? And I say it is. For one thing, the Congress can try to block the clean power plan that Obama has put in place to reduce our emissions. But that's going to be difficult. They're going to have to. They're going to run into lawsuits from all kinds of groups. It's going to take a very long time. If the budget, as you were saying, if they cut off the funding, I think even that is very difficult. The Republicans did try to cut off some funding for the Green Climate Fund, which Obama promised last September in 2014 at a big UN event in New York, where there was 400,000 people in the street. And I think the churches and other groups have gone in and said, wait a minute, you shouldn't be cutting this. This is a promise that we made as a nation to the poor nations of the world. And to try to secure a strong treaty, agreement this year when we need to stick with our promise. So I think that's now probably going to pass, or it's going to survive. And then there's the elections. Now, if there is a Republican president elected, it depends on, of course, who it is. There are very different positions. But, you know, we heard even Chris Christie, who's, I think, one of the most, willing to acknowledge that climate change is happening in that party and in the candidates. There will be a tougher time. But I think even a Republican president will have trouble undoing a lot of what's been done. And I think one of the problems that the Republicans face is that the young voters and a lot of their party is really moving on this issue. The polls are showing, just even this year, much stronger majorities supporting strong action on climate change and supporting the administration and what it's doing.
Jack Cushman, what about American credibility, authority in Paris? Do you see it being undermined by dissent at home and opposition to some of these moves, or does it appear strong?
Well, I think that it's remarkable that the United States is the only representative democracy in the world that has a legislative majority who is out actively trying to block this treaty. I don't think that that's a viable long-term position for the Republican Party to take, and eventually the forces at work here are going to overwhelm that position. I think that however long it takes, the world is going to move away from fossil fuels, just as the world moved away from whale oil. And eventually we're going to find that clean, green, and less expensive technologies just swamp the fossil fuel industry. And at that point, they will lose their clout in Congress, because you can't sustain industry-driven majority position in Congress when the industry itself is going down the drain.
Timms Roberts, do you anticipate champagne flowing on Friday night at midnight or sometime over the weekend, a success or otherwise?
I predict a success. I'm cautiously optimistic. The question is whether it's going to be strong enough to make that shift that Jack was just describing happen fast enough to avoid these major changes in the world.
Timmons Roberts with Brown University and the Brookings Institution. Thank you very much for being with us today, Timmons.
Thanks, Tom. Appreciate the pleasure.
Jack Kish Cushman in Paris with Inside Climate News. Thank you, Jack.
You're welcome.
And our thanks to young Adam Goldstein of Emory University and Newton, Massachusetts, with us for a moment from Paris today. Thanks to you all for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.